The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. Hope you all had a happy Thanksgiving. Today, I'll start out with a Thanksgiving story from the fiction section of the November 20th, 2000 issue of the New Yorker magazine, The Women of This World by Anne Beatty. The dinner was going to be good. Dale had pureed leeks and salsify to add to the pumpkin in the food processor. A tablespoon or so of sweet vermouth might give it a little zing, and as baby girl Pink streaked through the gray blue sky over the field, she dropped a CD into the player and listened matter-of-factly to Lou Reed singing matter-of-factly, "I'm Just a Gift to the Women of This World." By now, her husband Nelson would be on his way back from Logan, bringing his stepfather Jerome and Jerome's girlfriend Brenda, who had taken the shuttle from New York after much debate about plane versus train versus driving. For the annual, did 3 years in a row make something annual? Pre-Thanksgiving dinner. They could have come on Thanksgiving, but Dee Dee, Jerome's ex and Nelson's mother, was coming that day, and there was no love lost between them. Brenda didn't like big gatherings anyway. Brenda was much younger than Jerome. She used to nap half the afternoon because she was shy, Jerome said, but lately, her occupation had become glamorous, and she had quit teaching gym at the middle school to work as a personal trainer. And suddenly, she was communicative, energized, radiant, if that wasn't a cliche for women in love. Dale turned on the food processor and felt relieved as the ingredients liquefied. It wasn't that the food processor hadn't always worked, when she placed the blade in the bottom correctly, that is, but that she feared it wouldn't work. She always ran through a scenario in which she'd have to scoop everything out and dump it in the old wearing blender that had come with the rented house in Maine, and that didn't always work. With blenders so cheap, she amazed herself by not simply buying a new one. Nelson was forever indebted to Jerome for appearing on the scene when he was 5 years old and staying until he was 16. Jerome had seen to it that Nelson was spared being sent to Groton and had taught him to play every known sport, at least every ordinary sport. But would Nelson have wanted to learn, say, archery? Nelson wanted to learn everything, though he didn't want to do everything. He was happy to have quit teaching and wanted to do very little. He liked to know about things, though. That way he could talk about them. Her cruel nickname for him was No First-Hand Knowledge Nelson. It got tedious sometimes, people writing down the names of books from which Nelson had got his often esoteric information. People calling after the party was over, having looked up some strange assertion of Nelson's in their kids' Encyclopedia Britannica, and discovered that he was essentially right, but not entirely. They often left these quibbles and refutations on the answering machine. Dick here, listen, you weren't exactly right about Mercury. It's because Hermes means mediator in Greek. So there is an element of logic to his taking the souls of the dead to the underworld. Nelson, this is Pauline. Listen, Rush did write the introduction to that Glenn Baxter book. I can bring it in next time and show you. He really does write introductions all the time. Well, thanks to both of you for a great evening. My sister really appreciated Dale's copying that recipe for her, though no one can make butterflied lamb like Dale, I told her. Anyway, okay, bye, thanks again. Jerome and Brenda would be 20 or 30 minutes away, assuming the plane landed on time, which you could never assume if you knew anything about Logan. Still, Dale could manage a quick shower, if not a bath, and she should probably change into a dress because it seemed a little oblivious to have people over when you were wearing sweats. Maybe a bra under the sweater. A pair of corduroys instead of the super comfortable sweats. And shoes. Definitely some sort of shoes. Nelson called on the cell phone. Need anything? He said. She could hear Terry Gross's well-modulated, entirely reasonable voice on the radio. Only Nelson and Terry and her guest were talking in the car. The passengers were silent. in case Dale had forgotten some necessary ingredient. Yes, pink peppercorns. Try finding them on 95 North. And, of course, they weren't really peppercorns. They were only called peppercorns because they looked like black peppercorns, or purple oregano, an entirely different flavor from green. Not a thing, she said. She had changed into black corduroy pants and a white shirt. Keeping it clean would preoccupy her, give her some way to stay a little detached from everyone. She was shy, too, though she wore bad girl black boots. Brenda wants to see the wedding cake house. I thought we'd swing by. Would that mess up your timing? I didn't cook anything, Dale said. Silence then. Unkind of her to set his mind scrambling for alternatives. Kidding, she said. She had toured the wedding cake house soon after they moved to the area. It was in Kennebunk, a huge yellow and white creation with Gothic spires like pointed phalluses. Legend had it that it had been built by a sea captain for his bride to remind her of their wedding night when he left for sea. We'll be back around 4. Someone else was talking to Terry Gross in a deep, earnest voice. See you soon, Nelson said. Hon, he said. Bye, Dale said. She picked up 2 bottles of red wine from the wine rack near the phone, a little too close to the heat grate, so no wine was kept on the last 4 shelves. Not a problem in summer, but a minor inconvenience come cold weather. She remembered that Brenda had been delighted with a Fumé Blanc she'd served last time and bought the same bottle for her again. Jerome, of course, because of his years in Paris, would have the Saint Emilion. Nelson had taken to sipping Jameson's lately. Still, she'd chilled several bottles of white because he was unpredictable. On the top rack lay the bottle of Opus 1, an appreciative student from the photography workshop she'd taught had given her. 2 nights later, she planned to serve it to the doctor who had diagnosed both her hypoglycemia and her Meniere's disease, which meant, ironically, that she could no longer drink. If she did, she'd risk more attacks of the sickening vertigo that had plagued her and gone misdiagnosed for years, leaving her sweaty and trembling and so weak she'd often have to stay in bed the day after the attack. Like taking acid and getting swept up in a tidal wave, she said to the otolaryngologist. The woman had looked at her with surprise, as if she'd been gathering strawberries and suddenly came upon a watermelon. Quite a vivid description, the doctor had said. My husband is a writer. He sometimes stops me dead in my tracks the same way. Is he Brian McCambry? Dale had asked. Yes, the doctor said. Again, she seemed surprised. Nelson had been the one who speculated that Dr. Anna McCambry might be the wife of Brian McCambry. Dale herself had read only a few pieces by McCambry, though Nelson, as she told the doctor, had read her many others. I'll pass on the compliment, the doctor said. Now back to the real world. What a strange way to announce the transition, Dale had thought, though her symptoms sometimes were the real world for her, crowding out any other concerns. What was more real than telescoping vision, things blurring and swarming you so that you had no depth perception, no ability to stand? The doctor talked to her about alterations in her diet, prescribed diuretics, said so many things so fast that Dale had to call the nurse later that afternoon to be reminded what several of them had been. The doctor had overheard the call. Bring your husband and come for drinks, and I'll go over this with you while they talk, the doctor had said. Drinks, in your case, means seltzer. Thanks, Dale said. No doctor had ever asked to see her outside the office. She opened the Fumé Blanc, but left the bottle of Saint Emilion corked. How did she know? Maybe Jerome would decide to go directly to the white French Burgundy. What hadn't seemed fussy and precious before did now. A little. People and their wine preferences. Still, she indulged the vegetarians in their restrictions, knew better than to prepare veal for anyone, unless she was sure it wouldn't result in a tirade. Her friend Andy liked Stillwater. Her photography student Nance preferred Perrier. Dale's mind was full of people's preferences and quirks, their mystical beliefs and food taboos. their ways of demonstrating their independence and their dependency at table. The little test, where there happened to be sea salt, was there a way to adjust the pepper grinder to grind a little more coarsely? A call for chutney. That one had really put her over the top. There was Stonewall chicken, roasted garlic, and onion jam already on the table. She had sent Nelson for the chutney, since Paul was more his friend than hers. She went into the downstairs bathroom and brushed her hair, gathering it back in a ponytail. She took off the white shirt and changed back into her cashmere sweater, giving it a tug she knew she shouldn't give it to make sure it fell just right. She looked at her boots and wished it were still summer. She'd been more comfortable barefoot, but it wasn't summer, and her feet would freeze. She remembered that Julia Roberts had been barefoot when she married Lyle Lovett. Julia Roberts and Lyle Lovett, not as strange as Michael Jackson and Lisa Marie Presley. Brenda came in first, shaking her thick mane of prematurely white hair. She was full of enthusiasm about the trip to the wedding cake house. It was amazing, beautiful, somehow sort of weird, a little creepy, some woman living inside her wedding cake like the old woman who lived in a shoe. Then Brenda began apologizing. She had insisted they drive down the longest dirt road in history to get a basket of apples. Nelson put the basket down on the kitchen island, which Dale would soon need every inch of to do the final dinner preparations. She could no longer eat apples or anything excessively sweet. She was sick of explaining to people what she couldn't eat and why. In fact, she had started to say that she was diabetic, since everyone seemed to know that that meant you couldn't eat sugar. There was also the possibility that the apples might be Brenda and Jerome's to take back to New York, so she said, "Nice," rather than "Thank you." The real owners of the house obviously must have loved to cook. The kitchen was well laid out, with the exception of the dishwasher being to the left of the sink. Dale had become so adept at using her left hand to load the dishwasher that she thought it might be amusing to be both diabetic and left-handed. By the time she left the house, she might be an entirely different person. "It's great to see you. Did you get my note? You didn't go to a lot of trouble, did you?" Jerome said, squeezing Dale and then letting go. Brenda was still in a dither. "We didn't mess you up, did we?" she said. "No, not at all," Dale said. "I shouldn't ask, but I've been cooped up in the plane and then in the car. Would there be enough time to take a quick walk?" "Sure," Dale said. She had just put the roast in the oven to bake. There was plenty of time. "Would you mind if Nelson and I take a look at that wiring problem? I'm much better when there's natural light," Jerome said. "Oh, he's on his kick again about how he can't see or hear," Brenda said. And she added, as if they didn't know, "He's 64. "What wiring problem?" Dale said. She wanted to be barefoot. She wanted to be Julia Roberts with a big, dazzling smile. Instead, she could feel the skin between her eyebrows tightening. "Wiring problem?" The way Brenda talked got into her brain. In her presence, she started thinking in concerned italics. "I was trying to hook up speakers in the upstairs hallway. I can get one of them going, but not the other. Might be a bad speaker," Nelson said. Nelson had spent a good portion of his book advance on new sound equipment. His compromise with Dale was, when guests arrived, there would be no music. So far, the day had consisted of bluegrass, Dylan's first electric album, Japanese ceremonial music, an hour or so of La Boheme, and Astor Piazzolla. Dale had listened to the weather report and one cut from a Lou Reed CD that she imagined might be Thoreau's theme song. She was fond of Jerome, but he did think he was God's gift to women. "You'll come on a walk with me, won't you?" Brenda said. She was wearing shoes that would have been inappropriate for a walk if she hadn't been Brenda. Brown, pointy-toed boots with 3-inch heels. This here's hip look. While Dale's had become the generic. Brenda had shrink-wrapped herself into a black leather skirt worn over patterned pantyhose. On top was a sweater with a stretched-out turtleneck that Dale thought must be one of Jerome's. He had kept his collection of French hand-knit sweaters for 20-some years. "Just down the road," Dale said, gesturing to the dirt road that went past the collapsed greenhouse behind the garage. She liked the road. You could usually see deer at this time of the evening. Also, because of the way the road dipped, it seemed as though you were walking right into the sky, which had now turned Hudson River School radiant. Dale's friend, Janet LeBeau, was the only year-rounder at the end of the road. When the nasty summer people left, taking their Dobermans and their shiny four-wheel drives with them, Janet was happy not only to let Dale walk the no-trespassing, danger-posted, keep-out road. Janet usually sent her dog, Tyrone, who was afraid of the summer dogs, out to exercise with Dale. Janet was divorced, 50 going on 25, as exuberant as a teenager. She often had a crush on some new boyfriend. Devoted to tabloids, late-night movies, astrological forecasts, and fun. Temporary tattoos of things like unicorns leaping over rainbows. She was not a stupid woman, only childish and a little too upbeat, traumatized by her ex-husband's verbal abuse. Janet shuddered when she mentioned her ex-husband's name and rarely talked about the marriage. Tyrone was a smart golden retriever, black lab mix. When he wasn't in the tributary to the York River, he was wriggling in the field trying to shed fleas. The dog and the kitchen were the two things Dale felt sure she would miss most when they had to vacate the house. They had it through the following summer, when the philosophy professor and his wife would return from their year in Munich. By then, Nelson's book would supposedly be finished. Dale knew she was not going to enjoy the homestretch. Nelson had written other books, which inevitably made him morose because of the enormousness of the task. Then the music selections would become really eclectic. Dale reached into the flower bin of the Hoosier cabinet and took out her secret stash of donut holes, which she bought on Saturdays at the Portsmouth Farmers Market. She did not eat donut holes. They were exclusively for Tyrone, who thought Dale had invented the best game of fetch imaginable. He would race for the donut hole, sniff through the field for it, throw it in the air so Dale could see he'd got it, and then gulp it down in one swallow. She had taken to applauding. Lately, she had started to add, "Good dog, Tyrone," to the applause. "Is that cigarettes?" Brenda whispered to Dale, though Nelson and Jerome were already walking up the stairs. "Donut holes," Dale whispered back. "You'll see." She plunged what remained of them in their plastic bag into the deep pocket of her coat. "I keep M&Ms in my lingerie drawer," Brenda said. "And Jerome, you know, he doesn't think I know he still drinks Pernod." "It's for a dog," Dale said. "Pernod?" Brenda said. "No, donut holes. What do you mean?" "Come on," Dale said. "You'll see." At dinner, during which Dale could sense Brenda's respect for her, both as a cook and as a crazy woman, she'd sent three donut holes up in the air at the same time, like the last moments of the 4th of July fireworks. They discussed the brass sundial Dale had placed atop autumn leaves in the center of the table. Nelson informed everyone that the piece sticking up was called the gnomon, spelled G-N-O-M-O-N. "Gnomon is an island," Jerome said. Jerome very much enjoyed wordplay and imitating dialects. Dialect from the islands was currently his favorite. He and Brenda had recently vacationed in Montego Bay. "And this is the shadow," Nelson said, pointing, ignoring Jerome's silly contribution. "This is the plate. This is the hour, line, this the dial or diagram." "You are a born teacher," Brenda said. "I broke the habit," Nelson said. He had. He had resigned when the theorists outnumbered what he called the sane art historians. Worried that his ex-colleagues would resent his work with Roman coins, he was fond of stressing that he was not a numismatist. Dale had left with him, retaining only two loyal students who drove hours each week to work with her in the darkroom. Grattan or no Grattan, he had such an interest in knowledge that we had nothing to worry about with Nelson. I wore her down, and I was right to have done it, Jerome said. The time would never come when Jerome would not want to be thanked one more time for having saved Nelson, as they both thought of it, from the clutches of Groton. Which I thank you for, Nelson said. And if I'd been around at your birth, I could have stopped her from naming you for a sea captain, Jerome said. Oh, Nelson is a lovely name, Brenda said. Of course, if I'd been around at your birth, people might have suspected something funny was going wrong, Jerome said. I thought you met Dee Dee in Paris when Nelson was 5 or 6, Brenda said. He was 4. He was 5 when we got married. Dee Dee had gone to Paris to study painting. Actually, she was having an affair with her theosophy instructor. That hadn't had a happy ending, though Dee Dee had met Jerome at Le Deux Mogul. No snail-like dawdling, by her own admission, she had struck with the speed of a snake. I don't understand what you meant then when you said, if I'd been around, Brenda said. I was just saying it. If things had been otherwise, other than what they were, if... But I think you implied that you knew Dee Dee when she gave birth, didn't he? Brenda said. Brenda, you were a child when all this happened. You need not be jealous, Jerome said. I know I should let this drop, Jerome, but it seems sort of strange to suggest you might have been there, Brenda said. Am I being too literal-minded again? Yes, Nelson said. Well, no, I mean, sometimes I feel like something is being said between the lines, and because I'm a newcomer, I don't quite get it.
I've lived with you for 6 years, Brenda, Jerome said. He said it with finality, as if she would do well to drop the subject if she wanted to live with him another 6 seconds. Brenda said nothing. Dale gestured to the soup tureen beside the sundial. Also on the table was a silver bowl of freshly snipped chives and a little Chinese dish, enameled inside, that Dale had found for a quarter at a tag sale. People in the area did not value anything they were selling that was smaller than a beach ball. The Chinese dish was an antique. Inside, there was a pyramid of unsweetened whipped cream.
Fabulous, fabulous soup, Jerome said. So when are you going to let me bankroll your restaurant?
He'd wanted Dale to open a restaurant in New York for years. Jerome had all the money in the world, inherited when his parents died and left him half the state of Rhode Island. Since Jerome was a part-time stockbroker, he'd managed to invest it wisely. Back in the days before Dale showed her photographs at a gallery on Newbury Street in Boston, it had been more difficult to dismiss Jerome's ideas. So how's the photography coming? He said when she didn't answer. Brenda was still eating her soup, not looking up.
Well, I've got some interesting stuff I've been working on, Dale said. The woman down the road, she gestured into the dark. Only a tiny blinking light from the bridge to Portsmouth could be seen, far in the distance. There's one woman who lives there year-round, heating with a wood stove, and I've taken photographs.
Well, it always sounds so stupid, talking about what you're photographing. It's like paraphrasing a book, she said, hoping to elicit Nelson's sympathy.
Just the general idea, Jerome said.
Well, she does astrological charts for people, and they're really quite beautiful. And she has amazing hands, like Georgia O'Keeffe's. I photographed her hands as she makes marks on the parchment paper. Hands say so much about a person because you can't change your hands. The longer she talked, the more stupid she felt.
Have you had your chart done? Jerome asked. The stiffness of disapproval registered in his voice.
No, Dale said. I had my chart done once, Brenda said. It was apparently very unusual because all my moons were in one house.
Jerome looked at her. Dee Dee believed in astrology, he said. She thought we were mismatched because she was a Libra and I was a Scorpio. This apparently gave her license to have an affair with a policeman.
I'm not Dee Dee, Brenda said flatly. She had evidently decided not to let Jerome relegate her to silence. Dale was proud of her for that.
Will you carve the roast? Dale said to Nelson. I'll get the vegetables out of the oven.
She felt a little bad about leaving Brenda alone at the table with Jerome, but Nelson was much better at carving than she was.
She stood and began collecting soup bowls.
"Does that woman with the earmuffs still see you?" Dale said to Brenda as she picked up her bowl, very offhanded, as if the conversation had been going fine. It would give Brenda the excuse to rise and follow her into the kitchen if she wanted to. But Brenda didn't do that. She said, "Yeah, I've gotten to like her a little better, but her worrying about losing body heat through her ears, you've got to wonder."
"All the world is exercising," Jerome said. "Brenda has more requests for her services than she can keep up with. The gym stays open until 10 at night now on Thursdays. Do you two exercise?" "There's an exercycle in the downstairs bedroom. Sometimes I do it while I'm watching CNN," Nelson said. Jerome gave his little half nod again. "And you?" he said to Dale. "Still doing the 50 sit-ups? You're looking wonderful, I must say." "She can't," Nelson said, answering her. "The Meniere's thing. It screws up her inner ear if she does that sort of repetitive activity."
"Oh, I forgot," Brenda said. "How are you feeling, Dale?"
"Fine," she said. Things were better. The problem would never go away unless, of course, it spontaneously went away. Things had been so bad because the hypoglycemia complicated the problem, and that was pretty much under control. But she didn't want to talk about it. "Remind me of what you can't eat," Jerome said. "Not that we wouldn't be too intimidated to have you to dinner anyway. Better to reciprocate at a restaurant in the city."
"You don't have to reciprocate," Dale said. "I like to cook." "I wouldn't be intimidated," Brenda said.
"You wouldn't," he said. "I stand corrected."
"It can be a problem when you're really good at something. No one will even try to do that thing for you," Brenda said. "There's a girl at work who gives the best massage in the world, and nobody will touch her because she's the best. The other day I rubbed Chester's shoulders, and she almost swooned."
"Taking up massage also," Jerome said.
"What do you mean also?" Brenda said. "This is about the fact that you don't like me working late on Thursdays, isn't it? I might remind you that if a client calls, whatever time it is, it's nothing for you to be on the phone for an hour."
"No fighting," Nelson said.
"We're not fighting," Jerome said. "Well, you've been trying to provoke a fight with me," Brenda said.
"Well, then it was unconscious. I apologize," Jerome said.
"Oh, honey," Brenda said, getting up, pushing her napkin on the table.
She went around the table and hugged Jerome. "She likes me again," Jerome said. "We all like you," Nelson said. "I personally think you saved my life." "That goes too far," Jerome said. "I just wasn't one of those stereotypically indifferent stepfathers. I considered it a real bonus that I could help raise you."
"If only you'd taught me more about electrical problems," Nelson said.
"It's toggled together, but it should hold until I get my hands on a soldering gun," Jerome said. "But seriously, Dale, what do you think the prognosis is about this thing you have?"
Roasted vegetables cascaded into the bowl. Dale put the Pyrex dish carefully into the sink and opened a drawer looking for a serving spoon.
"I'm fine," she said.
"It's complicated," Nelson said. "She eats nothing but walnuts and cheese sticks for breakfast. You think she looks good? Will she still if she loses another 15 pounds?
"Cheese is full of calories," Dale said.
It was going to be impossible not to talk about it until everybody else's anxiety was alleviated. She lowered her voice.
"Come on, Nelson," she said. "It's boring to talk about."
"Cheese? What's with the cheese?" Jerome said.
"Honey, you are cross-examining her."
"So, here is some fresh applesauce, and here are the vegetables. I'll put them by you, Jerome, and Nelson's got the roast," Dale said, going back to her chair. The chairs were Danish modern, with a geometric quilted pattern on the seats. Apparently the professor and his wife had also had a sabbatical in Denmark.
"Oh, you already had apples. I knew you would," Brenda said.
"Well, she wouldn't touch the applesauce. Pure sugar," Nelson said.
"Nelson," Dale said, "please stop talking about it," she asked. "Does anyone want water?"
"I think if you don't mind, I'll have that wine that Nelson told me you laid in," Jerome said.
"Absolutely," Dale said, getting up.
Nelson walked around her with the platter. "She has some wine called Opus 1 for the doctor who's coming to dinner.
When is it? Thursday? Nelson said. We were supposed to go there for drinks, but Dale countered with dinner here. Talk about being grateful.
What year? Jerome said.
It was a present, Dale said, from a student who's married to a wine importer, so I suspect it's good.
Nelson held the platter for Brenda to serve herself. Has it been properly stored? Jerome said. That could be an excellent wine. We can only hope nothing happened to it.
Dale looked at him. As interested as he'd ostensibly been in her health, the concern about the wine was far greater. She had thought, to begin with, that being so solicitous had actually been Jerome's way of pointing out her vulnerability. Poor Dale, who might have to be stretched out on the floor any second. It fit with his concept of women.
Nelson moved to Jerome's side. He was holding the bottle. 1985, he said.
You know, that is a very elegant wine indeed. Let me see that, Jerome said.
Jerome cradled the bottle against his chest. He looked down at it, smiling. May I, as the person who once saved your husband's life, ask what you would think about my opening this to go with dinner, he said.
Jerome, Brenda said, give that back to Nelson.
Nelson looked at Dale with an expression somewhere between perplexity and pleading. It was just a bottle of wine. She had no reason to think the doctor or her husband were wine connoisseurs. There was that bottle of Saint-Emilion, but it would have seemed churlish to mention it now.
Absolutely, Dale said.
She pushed her chair back and went to the cupboard and took out their own stemmed glasses with a wide bowl which they had brought with them, along with her duvet and the collection of cooking magazines. Dale put a glass at everyone's place. Jerome was smiling.
We can only hope, he said.
Brenda was looking at Dale, but Dale did not meet her eyes. She was determined to let them all see that she was unconcerned. Jerome was usually so polite.
Tell me, he said, wine bottle clamped between his legs, turning the corkscrew. Surely you aren't going to decline one small glass of this, Dale?
I can't drink, she said.
Then what is that glass for, he said.
Perrier, she said, pronouncing the word very distinctly.
Jerome looked attentively at the bottle as he slowly withdrew the cork. He picked up the bottle slowly and sniffed. Then he put his white linen napkin over his finger and worked it around the top inside the bottle. That was the first time it became clear to her that he was doing what he was doing out of anger. She picked up her fork and speared a piece of eggplant.
You've fallen silent, Dale, he said. Is everything all right?
Yes, she said, trying to sound mildly surprised.
It's just that you're so quiet, he persisted.
Brenda seemed about to speak, but said nothing. Dale managed to shrug.
I hope
there are enough spices on the vegetables, she said. I roasted them without salt. Would anyone like salt?
Of course, since they had all now turned their attention to Dale, whatever she said sounded false and shallow.
I appreciate your laying in Mahon Lugny for me, Jerome went on. In most cases, white would go well with pork roast, but an 85 Opus 1, that, of course, is completely divine.
Jerome sniffed the bottle. It might have been snuff he inhaled so deeply. Then he set the bottle on the table near the sundial. Let it breathe for a moment, he said.
He turned his chair at an angle, feigning closeness with Dale.
Dale picked up a piece of carrot with her fingers and bit into it. She said nothing.
You had Dee Dee to dinner last month with some friends of yours, I hear, he said.
Who had told him, since he and Dee Dee didn't speak?
Nelson, obviously.
Why?
Yes, Dale said.
Jerome took a bite of meat and a bite of vegetable. He reached for the applesauce and ladled some onto his plate. He said nothing about the food.
I understand you've made a portrait of her, he said.
Brenda was chewing slowly. She knew, and Dale knew, that Jerome was warming up to something. In fact, Dale herself didn't much like Dee Dee, in part because they seemed to have little in common. On top of that, Dee Dee condescended by acting as if Dale were the sophisticate, and she the world traveler. Just a poor old lady. Dale had thought that photographing her, in spite of the momentary imbalance of power, might ultimately get the two of them on a more even footing.
Jerome said, I'd be curious to see it.
No,
Dale said. No? Why ever not? Jerome said.
You don't like your ex-wife, she said. There's no reason to look at a picture of her.
Listen to her, Jerome said, jutting his chin in Nelson's direction.
Jerome, what's wrong?
Nelson said quietly.
What's wrong? There's something wrong about my request to see a photograph. I have a curiosity about what Dee Dee looks like. We were married for years, you'll remember.
I don't want to see it, Brenda said.
You don't have to, and if you don't want any of the wine, you don't have to have that either.
Jerome twirled the bottle. As the label revolved in front of him, he picked up the bottle and poured. A thin stream of wine went into the glass.
I don't quite see how not wanting to look at a photograph of your ex means I don't want wine, Brenda said.
You prefer white, isn't that so? Jerome said.
Usually, but you made this wine sound very good.
It's good, but not great, Jerome said, inhaling. He had not yet taken a sip. He swirled the wine in his glass, then put the glass to his lips and slowly tilted it back. He said. He nodded. Quite good, but not perfect, he said. He cut a piece of roast.
Nelson kept his eyes on Dale, who was intent upon not looking at Brenda. Brenda was doing worse than anyone else with Jerome's behavior.
May I have a talk with you in the kitchen? Brenda said to Jerome.
Oh, just take me to task right here, in the great tradition of Dee Dee, who never lowered her voice or avoided any confrontation.
I'm not Dee Dee, Brenda said. What I want to know is whether you're acting this way because you're pissed off. I have a job I enjoy, and that means I'm not there to answer your every whim. Or whether there's some real bone you have to pick with Dale.
Forget it, Nelson said. Come on, Dale has made this wonderful meal.
Don't tell me what not to say to Jerome, Brenda said. Let's take another walk and cool off, Dale said to Brenda. Maybe they'd like to talk. Maybe we could use some air. All right, Brenda said, surprising Dale. She had thought Brenda would dig her heels in, but she seemed relieved by the suggestion.
She got up and walked through the kitchen and into the hallway where the coats were hung. In the dark, she put on Dale's jacket instead of her own. Dale noticed, but since they wore the same size, she put on Brenda's without comment. Outside, Brenda realized her error when she plunged her hand in the pocket and felt the donut holes.
Oh, this is yours, she said, and began to unzip the jacket.
Oh, we were the same size. Keep it on, Dale said. Brenda looked at her, making sure she meant it. Then she took her fingers off the zipper. As they walked, Brenda began apologizing for Jerome, though she said she'd only been guessing back at the house. She didn't really know what he was so angry about, though she assumed they knew that he was more fond of them than of his own children, those being the daughter he'd had by the woman between Dee Dee and Brenda, and the son whose mother was married to someone else.
He had a couple of beers on the plane. They took a bottle upstairs when they went to fix the wiring, too. Maybe he just had too much to drink, Brenda said.
It doesn't matter, Dale said. She pointed at the Portsmouth light.
I like that, she said. In the evening, I like the colorful sky. But at night, I liked that one little light almost as much.
Dale tried to look at her watch, but couldn't read it.
Too late to round up Tyrone, she said.
She knew that it was, even without being able to see the time. In the distance, wind rustled the willows. They were walking where the path turned and narrowed between the divided field. It was Dale and Nelson's responsibility, as renters, to have the fields plowed, so the scrub wouldn't take over. In the distance, you could hear the white noise of cars on the highway. That and the wind rustling disguised the sound of tires until a black car with its headlights off was almost upon them. Brenda clutched Dale's arm as she jumped in fear, moving so quickly into the grass in her high-heeled boots that she lost her balance and fell, toppling both herself and Dale.
"Oh, my ankle," she said. "Oh, no."
Both were sprawled in the field, the hoarfrost and the grass crunching like wintry quicksand as they struggled to stand. A car without headlights? And after nearly sideswiping them, it accelerated. The big shadow of the car moved quickly away.
crunching stones more loudly as it receded than it had on the approach. Brenda had turned her ankle. Dale helped her up, dusting wetness from her own jacket on Brenda's back, wanting to delay the moment when Brenda would say she couldn't walk.
"Some goddamn maniac," Dale said. "Can you put pressure on it? How does it feel?"
"It hurts, but I don't think it's broken," Brenda said. Dale looked into the distance, Brenda's hand still on her shoulder.
"Damn," Brenda said. "I'd better take these things off and walk home in my tights. You know, if I didn't know better, I'd say that was Jerome zeroing in for the kill."
"Kill?" With a worse chill than the night air explained, Dale had realized that the car must have been speeding away from Janet's house. That they would have to go on, she at least would have to go on and see what had happened.
"It's something bad," Dale began.
"I know," Brenda said, crying now.
"But the worst thing is that I'm pregnant, and I don't dare tell him. He's been so awful to me lately. It's like he hates me. I feel like he'd like it if my ankle was broken."
"No," Dale said, hearing what Brenda said, but not quite hearing it.
"Something at the house, down there, Janet's house."
Brenda's hand seized Dale's shoulder.
"Oh, my God," she said. "Wait here," Dale said. "No, I'm coming with you," Brenda told her.
"I've got a very bad feeling," Dale said. "We don't know," Brenda said.
"It could have been kids, drunk, playing a game with the lights out."
From the tenuous way she spoke, it was clear she didn't believe it herself. Slowly, helping her to walk, Brenda's boots in one of her hands, the other around Brenda's waist, Dale moved forward with Brenda until the little house came in sight.
"Not exactly a wedding cake," Brenda said, squinting at what was hardly more than a clapboard shack.
There was one light on, which was an ambiguous sign. It could be good, or it could mean nothing at all. The front door, slightly ajar, was the worst possible sign. Dale surprised herself by having the courage to push it open. Inside, the wood fire had burned out. A cushion was on the floor. A mug lay near it, in a puddle of whatever had been inside. The house was horribly, eerily silent. It was rare that Dale found herself surrounded by silence.
"Janet?" Dale said. "It's Dale! Janet?"
She was on the kitchen floor. They saw her when Dale turned on the light. Janet was breathing shallowly. A small trickle of blood congealed at one side of her mouth. Dale's impulse was to gather Janet in her arm, but she knew she should not move her head.
"Janet, everything's going to be okay,"
she heard herself say dully. She meant to be emphatic, but instead her voice was monotonic. Her ears had begun to close, a warning that she would soon have an attack of vertigo. But why? She had drunk no wine. She had eaten no sugar. Panic attacks had been ruled out when Meniere's had been ruled in.
"You must learn the power of positive thinking," she heard the doctor saying to her. "I know it sounds ridiculous, but it works. I'm not a mystical person. It's more like biofeedback. Say to yourself, 'This will not happen to me.'"
The room was quivering, as if the walls themselves were vibrating because of some tremor in the earth. Dale repeated the words silently. She could see Janet's chest rising and falling. Her breathing did not seem to be labored, though whoever had been there had evidently tried to strangle her with a piece of rope. From the color of her face, it was obvious she had been deprived of oxygen. Her long fingers were balled into fists. Blood oozed from a cut on her arm. An ankh dangled from one end of the rope. The dictionary of symbols lay on the floor, a blood-smudged chart beside it. Beside that, torn from the wall, was a photograph Dale had taken of Janet's hand holding the fine, pearwood-handled brush she had used to draw symbols. The photograph had been ripped so that the brush was broken in half. Remembering, suddenly, what she must do, Dale went to the wall phone and dialed 911.
"Someone is unconscious at the end of Harmony Lane," she said.
It was difficult to tell how loud or soft her words were. Harmony Lane, was that what she had just said? What ridiculous place was that? Some fake street?
in some ridiculous Walt Disney development? But no, they hadn't gone there. They had rented a house in Maine. That was where they were. She squinted against the star shining through the kitchen window, like a bright dart aimed at her eye. It was not a star, though. It was the light from Portsmouth. The woman who answered told Dale to stay calm. She insisted she stay where she was. It was as if all this were about Dale, not Janet, but Dale standing in Janet's kitchen. For a second, the voice of the woman at 911 got confused with the voice of the doctor saying, "This will not happen to me." There was a shriek of sirens. They sounded far, far away, yet distinct. Background music that portended trouble. Dale was so stunned that instead of hanging up, she stood with the phone in her hand, imagining she'd hung up. She had seen Janet 2 days before. Three? They had talked about squash. The squash Janet would appreciate Dale's buying for her at the farmer's market. "This is her neighbor, Dale," she said, in what she thought was an answer to the question the woman was asking, faintly on the opposite end of the phone. Why didn't the woman ask about Janet? "We saw a car," she heard herself say, though her mouth was not near enough to the receiver for the 911 operator to hear. That was the moment when Tyrone burst out from underneath the two-seat sofa, charging so hard he overshot Dale and knocked Brenda down. She screamed with fear long after she might have realized it was only a dog. Tyrone was as afraid as they were. Everything was made worse by Brenda's high-pitched scream. "Oh, God, I'm so sorry," Brenda said, apologizing to the cowering dog, his back legs shaking so pathetically. Dale could not see how he remained upright. "Oh, God, here," Brenda said, inching closer, reaching in the jacket pocket with a trembling hand for a donut hole and holding it out to the dog, who did not approach but stood shakily leaning into Dale's leg. No one looked at Janet's body. Wind rattled the glass, but the louder sound was that of sirens. Dale saw Brenda cock her head and turn as if she could see the sound. Brenda turned back and threw the donut hole to the dog, missing by a mile. "It's okay," Dale said, moving her leg astride the dog and edging the donut hole toward him with the toe of her boot. It was a powdered sugar donut hole that left a streak of white on the floorboards. By Janet's hand had been a streak, no, a puddle, not a streak, of blood. Dale did not look in that direction. She was so afraid Janet might have stopped breathing. Dale looked across the room at Brenda. Brenda, dejectedly, was about to throw another donut hole. Dale watched as Brenda tossed it, slowly repeating Dale's words, "It's okay." Then Brenda took a step forward and said to Dale, "Make him forgive me. Make him like me again." Dale was stroking Tyrone's head. Tyrone had become her dog. Brenda and Jerome's child, she thought, would become Brenda's child. All of Jerome's women had wanted babies, and he had bitterly resented everyone. The son born to the married woman in France, whose husband believed the child to be his. The daughter born as his marriage to his second wife was disintegrating. Nelson had been the only one he wanted. Well, if you had what you already consider the perfect child, maybe that made sense. Nelson was intellectually curious, smart, obedient, favoring his stepfather over his mother, a loyal child. Nelson and Jerome would be at the table finishing dinner, Nelson having found a way to excuse Jerome, Jerome's passive aggression subsiding into agreeableness, as if by the two women's disappearing, any problem automatically disappeared too. Without them, Nelson and Jerome could move on to the salad course, drink the entire bottle of Opus One. Nelson would probably have brought down the photograph of Dee Dee, her face deeply lined by years of having kept up with Jerome and his drinking, as well as by other bad decisions she had made. And, of course, from the years at Saint-Tropez, enjoying too much sun. Too much sun, S-U-N, too much sun, S-O-N. Jerome would like to play with that. Though what Jerome was talking about, having already told Nelson he was seriously considering separating from Brenda, was the story of Baron Philippe de Rothschild. The Baron, being a clever businessman and, more important, a visionary, realized that much might be gained by joining forces with the California wine grower Robert Mondavi. Mondavi was invited to the Baron's, where both men dined on fabulous food and drank great wine. It was a social evening. Business was not discussed. It was not until the next morning that the Baron, by this point Mondavi genuinely admired him for his taste, elegance, and good manners, summoned Mondavi to his bedside, like a character in a fairy tale. The possibility of combining their efforts was discussed, and of sharing the profits 50-50. Mondavi suggested producing only one wine, which would be similar to a great Bordeaux. Did he say this tentatively? The Baron agreed. Would he have said the same? The wine would be made in California, where the Baron's winemaker would visit. Mondavi, flattered, was thrilled as well. His name linked to that of Baron Philippe de Rothschild. The Baron also triumphed, realizing that embracing his would-be adversary would lead both men to profit. Nothing remained except the ceremonial drinking of a 100-year-old Mouton, followed by a very cold Chateau de Yenk, a perfect deal, a perfect meal. It even rhymed, as Jerome pointed out. A brilliant label was designed, providing the perfect finishing touch. The talk back at the house was about perfection. In a perfect world, all wines would be perfect. Ditto marriages. All books brilliant, a toast was drunk. Superior music, again glasses were raised, would be listened to keenly. In that fairy tale, which was not Dale's and which was not Brenda's either, no woman would lie badly wounded on her kitchen floor. Brenda crossed the room and stood at Dale's side. "Donut hole," she said quietly, looking down, then picked it up at the end of its trail of powdered sugar, as if plucking a shooting star from the darkness. This time, Tyrone showed interest. Dale picked up the other two. The dog was definitely interested now. There was no dirt on the donut holes that Dale and Brenda could see as they examined them closely. "Why not?" Dale said, giving voice to what Brenda was thinking. They could pretend to be people at a cocktail party, eating pleasant tidbits. But sirens pierced the night. They signified a problem for someone, Nelson knew. Another problem, Jerome also thought. The sound overwhelmed Bartok on the stereo. The sirens were shrill and constant. A sound, you might say, was annoyingly like a woman's voice, if one could still say such things. But, of course, one could not. Then the crescendo of noise, demanding their attention. One man preceded the other out of the house. That door, too, was left open to the wind. A police car, second police car, an ambulance, a fire engine, the full militia leading the way. To what? The two words were like a heartbeat. To what? To what? To what? To what? Down a dirt road in a country far from France. Down a narrow road across from a rented house. The meal left behind, one or the other having remembered to extinguish the candles. And now a poem from the November 20, 2023 issue of the New Yorker magazine. I Am a Prayer by Joy Harjo. I am a prayer. I am a prayer of rain in the desert when the flowering ones need a drink. I am a prayer. I am a prayer of sun when there is no end to night. I am a prayer. I am a prayer of ocean when there is no more blue. I am a prayer. I am a prayer of clouds when few make rain song. I am a prayer. I am a prayer of roads that lead everywhere but home. I am a prayer. I am a prayer of white birds who cannot fly through a storm of fear. I am a prayer. I am a prayer of fire who arrived to care for humans, then was dismissed to destroy. I am a prayer. I am a prayer of wind whose breathing carries seeds, pollen, and songs to feed the generations. I am a prayer. I am a prayer of moon who wears the night as a shawl to hide that which should never be spoken. I am a prayer. I am a prayer of grief when life gambled with death and gave up families for guns. I am a prayer. I am a prayer of smoke, wandering the broken houses, the littered ground, looking for a white flag of reason. I am a prayer. I am a prayer of mountains, those tall, humble ones who agreed to lift our eyes to see. I am a prayer. I am a prayer of forever making a path of beauty through the rubble of eternity. I am a prayer. I am a prayer of poetry, speaking the soundlessness of the dead who return to speak in prayer. I am a prayer with children on my back, roaming the earth, house of destruction and creation. I am a prayer without end. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.